The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Cass, in our last conversation, we spoke about the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and you mentioned in the course of that conversation that we should try to see that in the biblical text, almost, if you like, as if it were a split screen, where what's happening on top of the mountain is something very different than what's happening on the bottom of the mountain. Now, in this conversation, we're going to focus at the foot of the mountain, what's happening there. And I thought we might just begin with a sort of plot summary of what happens in those chapters of Exodus.
Good. While Moses is up on the mountain, getting the instructions for the building of the tabernacle, the people down below are restless. Moses has not returned. He's been gone a long time. They were not told how long he would be gone, and they turn to Aaron, who's been left in charge, and tell him, look, make for us gods who will go in his place. We don't know whether this man Moses, who took us out of Egypt, whether he's coming back or not. Aaron can't hold them off. He asks them to contribute their gold and silver. To his surprise, they provide it, and he fashions for them a golden young bull, so-called a golden calf, and tells them, tries to redirect their attentions to the Lord and says, tomorrow we'll have a celebration unto the Lord, but it's too late. The people the next day rally around this calf. They offer burnt offerings and peace offerings. They eat and they drink and they engage in licentious wildness, dancing and beyond. While this is going on, the scene goes back upstairs where God tells Moses, go down. Your people that you took out of Egypt, they have corrupted themselves. And he tells them the story of what's happening. And then he tells Moses, leave me alone. Let my anger burn against them so that I might destroy them. And I will make of you a great nation. Moses is astonished by this news. Rather than taking orders, he remonstrates with God. He makes an argument to him that, you're going to be embarrassed if you do this and destroy the people in whom you invested so much. You remember your promise to the patriarchs. You can't do this. And God relents and says, okay, I won't destroy them. With this reprieve, Moses descends the mountain only to discover how bad it really is. Moses, carrying the tablets of the law with him, sees the dancing and the wildness in the camp and smashes the tablets. He enters the camp. The first thing he does is he takes this golden calf. He burns it. He takes the ashes into the water, forces the people to drink it, remonstrates with Aaron, how did you let them do this? But then is faced with a political difficulty, what to do here. He has no allies except for Joshua, who came down the mountain with him. He divides the camp. He calls for people who are on the side of God. The Levites step forward. Moses, inventing a speech for God, tells them, God has asked you to go through the camp and each man slay his brother, his friend, and his neighbor. And the Levites, following Moses' orders, carry out his command, and 3,000 men are killed in that day. Moses, in a way, has restored order temporarily. The next day, he says he's going to go up and see if he can perhaps atone for the people because they have sinned badly. And then there follows a remarkable conversation between God and Moses, in which God finally, under Moses' promise, prodding, relents and it doesn't use the word forgive, but agrees to let them go to the promised land, agrees to reenact the covenant, agrees to go with them and to dwell in the tabernacle, in the process of which he gives Moses, on request, a revelation of some of his qualities previously unknown, not to by Moses and the reader. And at the end, Moses comes down bearing the new tablets, now his face aglow with reflected divine light.
Okay. So now we should maybe return to the beginning of this episode and try to just understand the, on the face of it, what it means to teach us. To begin with, I should like to ask what it means to teach us about the very desire that the people have for this object to worship in the first place.
Okay. Look, it's very easy to feel superior to the people and to look down upon them. The story is traditionally read as an example of the shameful, ungrateful, inconstant, slavish behavior of this mob of people. But these are ex-slaves. The Egypt is not out of their souls. Their great leader, Moses, has disappeared into the top of a fiery mountain. They'd like to move, but they have no leader. They have some kind of longing for being in touch with the higher powers, which have remained invisible. And with Moses gone, they don't know how they can be in touch with this. And they turn to Aaron and say, please provide us someone who will be in Moses' place, either to be a god to us in the sense of a beneficent leader, or possibly be a go-between, as Moses was to this supposed God that Moses claimed he was in touch with.
So we should really see them, we should see their instincts as an application of a kind of reverence.
It might be a little strong, but yeah, there's in a way there is some kind of need or longing to be in touch with powers beyond us. There might also be, we talked about the impulse to sacrifice last time. This could be an expression, a desire to express gratitude, or it could be a kind of wildness in the soul that seeks ecstasy and abandon. But one can't altogether blame them. And we somehow know of this human tendency from the fact that already in the Ten Commandments, the very first things that God says about how not to be in relation to him is you should have no other gods before me, and especially you should not make any graven images and worship them, as if God understands that the great human temptation is going to be multiple gods, and especially the worship of tangible, glistening likenesses, that the longing for some kind of worship, and which is in fact idolatry, the worship of false gods, is an endemic human possibility. The people have it. Here's the story when you see them first. By the way, this is the first time we've seen them since Moses left them blood-strewn in the ratification of the covenant. An episode that we thought was fraught with certain kinds of dangers of this sort. And now here they are, Moses is gone, and that impulse towards wildness, towards being in touch with God, it expresses itself right away.
So do you interpret the fact that this comes after that initial ratification of the covenant as an acknowledgement of the weaknesses of the human powers of reason, or of the insufficiency of those earlier spectacles that Moses had offered?
Well, I would say I take this, certainly the insufficiency of thinking, human reason, and even human law the insufficiency for dealing with the deep stirrings of the human soul. After all, they've just been given the law. It's just been ratified. Moses himself in that ratification ceremony seemed to suggest that the words alone, and the words in a way, backed by some divine authority will be sufficient to address the stirrings, the full stirrings of the human soul. So he himself instituted a ceremony that would somehow speak to those passions, a ceremony that involved the spreading of blood. The impulse to worship, the tendency towards wildness, the desire for merging, it doesn't simply yield to good speeches. And in fact, one could say that the tabernacle, the rules in great detail that were already elaborated in the chapters we discussed last time, seven chapters worth of a divine monologue of the details, that's an indication that these passions which here erupt down below can only be dealt with if they are provided a home and if they can be regulated by number, measure, and given expression in sacrifices with mediators who are also not like Aaron down below, but like Aaron when he gets his job as high priest, will be following directions for how to do this.
Well, let's pick up with the role of Aaron in this episode. We've now tried to sympathetically inhabit the point of view of the Israelites.
Right.
Let's try to do the same for Aaron.
Well, this story shows that Aaron is not the man that Moses is, but we knew that from the start. Aaron was enlisted in this enterprise presumably because he knew better how to talk to the people. Moses, and we'll talk about this later, he's taken this job, but he's never been of the people, and he has never yet referred to them as my people or as us. It's always your people or that people or this people. Aaron is much closer to the people. He's much more the people's representative. And I imagine he's been trying to hold them off for days. It doesn't say that they waited until the 40th day to do this. It says when the people saw Moses wasn't coming down, they began to remonstrate with Aaron, and they order him. I mean, they're 600,000 strong, and it's just Aaron. So he tries his best he can, but it's perfectly clear that the representative of the people turns out to be finally incapable of leading the people, but has to do their bidding. And that's what happens here. He thinks he can feed the beast by appeasing them, let him make a statue, but the next day turn their attentions to the Lord, but it's gone. I mean, he's fed the beast, and the beast is now hungry for more, and he's let them loose. And the text will say later, Aaron let them loose to be a disgrace among the nations.
I mean, this would seem to be an instantiation of the permanent dilemmas of the People's Tribune. And I suppose the question that it invites is, what might Aaron otherwise have done?
I don't know what Aaron might otherwise have done. And the relation between the leader and the led is never thematically discussed, but it's a question of the whole book. And the problem, I think, can be stated very simply. The leader has to be significantly above the people so that he has acknowledged authority, which he then can exercise over them. But he cannot be so high above them that they will worship him as a god, or he might have delusions of grandeur in relation to them. On the other hand, he can't be so close to the people that he's at risk of being overwhelmed by them. And he tries to govern them by appeasement or flattery, which is the only way he can handle them when they become unruly. So not too high and not too low. And the problem of Moses, the question of Moses' authority, we learn already at the very beginning. When he breaks up this fight amongst the Israelites back in Exodus 2, and the Israelites says to him, "Who made you a prince and judge over us?" Part of the task of this whole project is, how does Moses get the kind of authority he needs to lead, and to do so without undergoing an apotheosis with dangerous consequences. But Aaron, to come back to him, he was in a tough spot. I can't imagine what else he could have done.
Leon, I do want to come to Moses next. But before we do, I'd like to still trace this gold, which I'm so fascinated by.
Yeah.
The gold that was originally taken from the Egyptian neighbors.
Yeah. Look, this is really marvelous. As we said last time, many people think the gold is sort of partial reparations for the injustice and suffering done. But when you get to this part of the story, it's very clear. The gold has two possible uses, and as the story presents it, they're really mutually exclusive and exhaustive possibilities. The gold will either wind up in the tabernacle under the instructions Moses has just received, or it could acquire the use which it has here down below with Aaron's help to become the coating of a young bull, a symbol of virility, which, of course, the Egyptian-based ex-slaves would have known to celebrate. And I think it's a setup. In fact, you could say God has Moses up on the mountain for a long time, in part to find out, what's going to happen to this gold? I mean, is this gold going to be saved for me, in which case, problem solved? Or the gold is going to wind up in an idol in which we will have exposed the problem of idolatry, which has to be exposed sooner or later, and we're going to figure out a way to deal with it.
So that reading would suggest that the gold stands for a kind of moral orientation. It can be directed in toward this purpose or toward that.
No, exactly. I mean, it's like so many things in human life. Its uses and direction is not given by the thing itself, but by the human orientation and the orientation of the soul. And the great, the story in effect says, we're going to worship, we are going to somehow worship the Lord who deserves to be worshiped, or we're going to worship an object of our own making. Those are the exhaustive choices, and the story lays it just out there.
Okay, so now let's zoom out from the base of the mountain and refocus our attention on Moses.
Okay.
Pick up on the significance of what God has told him.
I'm inclined to think that the whole to say it's a setup is crude and vulgar, but I can't escape the sense that this episode had to happen, and indeed was not only necessary but in a certain way desirable to accomplish a lot of God's purposes. Idolatry has been exposed as the problem God has already told everybody it's likely to be, and better to have it exposed earlier. The question is, once it's exposed, how are we going to deal with it? Does he have a champion who can, in fact, establish order, punish this wrongdoing, but then take possession of these people as God's people, despite their weaknesses, and lead them forward? So I take it the first thing he does, he says to Moses, leave me alone so that I can be angry with them and destroy them, and I'll start over with you. And Moses treats this not as an order to be obeyed, but as an invitation to argue.
Well, we should say, to be fair to the text, that offer is preceded by a previous announcement on God's part.
Oh, yes.
To Moses of what's happening. And maybe we should pay particular attention, as you did in your summary just now, as does the text, to the pronouns that God uses in describing the relation of this people to Moses.
Yep. He says, go down to your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt. They have done such and such. And then he states exactly, quotes them, these are your gods which brought you out of Egypt. And he's in a way inviting Moses. It looks as if he's blaming Moses for this misconduct. But he's also in a way inviting Moses to own up to the fact that they are indeed his people. Moses doesn't do as he's told right away, but he remonstrates with God. He won't leave him alone, and he won't let him get angry to the point of destroying them. And he makes an argument using God's own previous words against him. The heart of it being, what will the Egyptians think if you brought them out of Egypt only to destroy them here? And by the way, you should remember your promises to the patriarchs of the promised land, et cetera, which is a subtle way of saying, you know, this offer that you've made me, that you can start over with me, what good are promises if those promises to the patriarchs aren't going to be honored? So he makes this argument, and God says to him, to Moses' relief, and as I'm reading, happily, that Moses has taken the case of the people. Moses has stepped up. He hasn't accepted the invitation, destroy them, start over, let them be my people. But he has argued on their behalf. And God relents. He says, I won't destroy them. With that reprieve, Moses now goes down the mountain, but the situation is completely changed. Moses is like a guy who's pulled a drowning man out of the river, who's jumped in to commit suicide. Moses is now responsible for them. And he comes down there. If God's not to destroy them, Moses has to deal with the situation on the ground for which no instruction has been given him. And he comes, he sees it's worse than he thought. I mean, God gave one episode, but it's still going on. He's coming down there dancing and frolicking and God knows what. And Moses sort of smashes the tablets and now is faced with this terrible political problem of what to do.
So the mood that Moses is in upon descending the mountain would seem to be a mood of proximity, embrace of the people of Israel, perhaps more than ever before. Why do I say that? I say that because after God's invitation that Moses consider the actions of his people, Moses' response is then to evoke the patriarchs of Genesis. Again, just to restate, whom he had maybe never heard of in his life before that moment of the burning bush, in which God announces that these are in fact his ancestors. So it would seem that Moses has now integrated a kind of Israelite history into his person.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I would go that far yet. I think it's on the way to that. But what he says to God in that in his rejoinder, he doesn't say my people. He says your people. He says, he says to him, basically, love your people. Right. Don't be disgraced among the Egyptians and keep your promises to these people. It's true. He echoes those names, which he'd never known before and had heard about only at the burning bush. It was the only time it had been mentioned in him. But it's still your people.
Right. One could read that as a kind of leverage that God has applied against himself.
Right. He's quoting God's previous passages, but also, and this I think is halfway to your point, Moses, the argument that Moses makes to God, love your people, don't be disgraced, and keep your promises, are also appropriate for Moses. Moses is also invested a lot in these people. Moses also would be a laughing stock after having appeared before Pharaoh and in a way won his case only now to have it shown to the world that these people weren't worth saving in the first place. And finally, Moses, what good are God's promises if look what he's done to these promises of the others? So Moses, in a way, is aligning himself with God in his argument with God, but he's not yet there to talking about we. That's down the road. And part of the reason I like this reading is, look, the situation on the ground to begin with is as follows. The people are still sort of slavish and prone to idolatry, as we find out immediately. We've been told in the covenant what happens if people obey the covenant. They're going to become God's treasure among the nations, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. There hasn't been a word said about what happens if they disobey, and if they disobey it flagrantly and foundationally. No idea. The covenant is at risk, but we don't really know what happens. God himself hasn't said. God himself hasn't said what will happen if there's disobedience and foundational disobedience. Is he going to destroy the people? Is he going to forgive them? Who's going to enforce any breakdown? And Moses still hasn't. He's taken the mission, but he hasn't really embraced these people yet.
Okay. So we've now witnessed God's anger.
Yep.
Heretical thing, perhaps, to say. But that's the way that the text presents it.
Yeah, yep.
We should now maybe...
Actually, it says, leave me alone so that I can be angry.
Yes.
It doesn't say God was angry.
Okay.
I mean, in other words, this could be part of... What I'm suggesting is God has to move Moses from being a mere leader following orders to a person who will fill the vacuum of leadership and take command of this people as God's champion amongst the people, despite their frailties, despite their weaknesses, which up until this point Moses has had only contempt for.
Okay. Nevertheless, Moses, we know, experiences a kind of anger.
Absolutely.
Having provisionally won this case, won this discussion with God, what does Moses see? What does he do?
He rightfully sees the scene in a kind of Dionysiac wildness. It's an astounding scene if you try to imagine it. It's one guy with Joshua and 600,000 men and poor Aaron. And Moses enters the scene. I assume the people are astonished to see the return of Moses and maybe a little ashamed. Moses immediately goes for the idol. He throws it in the fire. He burns it. He puts it in the water and he makes the people drink the water as if sort of ingesting the remnant of their sin and displaying the absolute impotence of this alleged deity that they were just moments ago celebrating and worshiping. He then turns to Aaron. He says to him, what did the people do to you that you let them go in this way? And Aaron makes a kind of lame excuse. He says, it wasn't me, Moses. You know these people. They're a stiff-necked people. You can't do anything with them. And by the way, I mean, you were up on the mountain, but almost sort of shifting blame. If you wouldn't have gone away and stayed up there so long talking to God about God knows what, if you'd been down here, this wouldn't have happened. That's between the lines. And finally, Aaron says, look, I took their gold and I threw it in the fire and out came this thing. I didn't do anything at all. And Moses, who's heard the instructions before that Aaron is going to be the high priest and somehow intuits that he still has a role to play here, doesn't say peep to Aaron. But I think he sees through this very lame thing. And instead, the problem is not dealing with Aaron. The problem is somehow restoring order. How to restore order? No allies. You don't know who's guilty. The text had told the reader all of the people are celebrating and worshiping this golden calf, Levites included, by implication. Moses figures out the way to do this is to divide the camp, start a small civil war, have a certain purification and restore order by means of violence. And he simply calls out, who is for the Lord? Come to me. And all of the Levites, the descendants of that spirited man, Levi, from whose line Moses himself is descended, who avenged the rape of their sister Dinah with his brother Simeon, the Levites come forward, now not to avenge their own, but to take the Lord's side in the cleaning up of this mess. And Moses, in one of the most shocking passages of all, says, God says, God told you, tells you, put a sword on your thigh and go through the camp from gate to camp, gate to gate, and every man kill his brother and his friend and his neighbor. The speech cuts, told him nothing at all. Moses is going to solve this, has to solve this problem on his own, and he finds this almost Machiavellian stratagem of, by force of arms, institute the peace, create the peace, and also purge by a kind of sacrificial offering, the shedding of blood, purge the pollution of the camp. With one small footnote, the text in its beauty reminds everybody that this was a necessary thing to do. Moses solved the problem, but the cost was horrific.
So then we should ask, why was it necessary? Why was it necessary that Moses solve this problem, a naturally occurring problem in the human soul, through this kind of violent display? Why was the civil war that he instigated an answer to that problem?
Well, I mean, look, there's a, the crowd has gone nuts. Order has to be restored. Moses actually, I mean, one should add something. Moses smashed the tablets on the way down. The people had violated the covenant, but Moses, in shattering the tablets, annulled it. And so we're back to the anarchic situation that we were in before the law. And the situation now calls for personal human leadership. There is no law. The question is how to restore some kind of order, in the hope that if order is restored, then one might be able to plead for the reinstitution of the law, the reinstitution of the covenant, and, God willing, the return of God's presence and the tabernacle. Small footnote, as an aside, Moses is now, it's not the first thing on his mind, but he's getting an education right here now as to why actually the tabernacle with sacrifices might be necessary in a way in which he never understood this before. But politically, we have anarchy. We have anarchy. The only person that can restore order is Moses, and he has to, and he doesn't know who the ringleaders are. This has to be somehow a cleansing, and a cleansing by blood, which will put terror into the people, establish his authority, because he now owns them. He's bought them from God, so to speak, by having pleaded for their life, and they're now his.
Okay. In its hard-headedness and appreciation for the trade-offs endemic in all human leadership and political life, you spoke about the costs that would be weighed upon the people and upon Moses for even such a necessary act as this one. What are they?
Well, I think the objective fact is 3,000 people are killed on this day. Without trials, I mean, and we don't know, it doesn't say, Moses doesn't say, kill the guilty. It just says, in a way, indiscriminately almost. There are, and those who fight back, you could say, might be therefore indicating their complicity and so on, but never mind. But the crucial point, I think, is when Moses says, slay every man his brother. And we talked already previously about the hope that this nation could be founded without fratricide, the fratricide which occurred in the founding of the first city with Cain, and the almost fratricide that threatened each of the patriarchal generations. Here we have Aaron on the side of the people. Aaron is in a way not killed for his transgression, but it's going to turn out that two of Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, will later be killed for a certain kind of excessive zeal in the performing of the sacrifices, where you could say, as predicted, the iniquity of the father will be visited upon the sons to the third or fourth generation. The iniquity connected with that passage in the Ten Commandments was connected to the problem of idolatry. There is a kind of hint that there will be still payment for this. This had to be done, but necessity doesn't simply excuse in the Bible. It's one of its beauties. Things get buried under rocks, and they come back and bite you.
Perhaps we should just follow Moses now back up and see what happens there.
Yeah, the next morning, Moses, and you could imagine the terror in the camp. The next morning at daybreak, Moses tells the people, "You have sinned a terrible sin." First he killed people, then he told them. And then he says, "Perhaps I'm going to go up. Perhaps I can atone for you."
I should say this is consistent with the people agreeing to the law before hearing the law.
Yeah.
That there is a tendency for the Bible to reveal a deep truth about human nature, which is that deeds preceding words
yep.
sometimes have a educative effect
yep.
that is deeper than the reverse, than words preceding deeds.
Yep. So Moses now goes back up, and he starts to plead for the people, not just for their non-destruction, which he succeeded in pleading for before the last time he was up. He's now, by the way, up for another 40 days and 40 nights. And he's now in a long process of negotiation. First of all, he's got to get back the promise of the promised land. He has to get back the reinstatement of the covenant. And most important, he wants enough of God's forgiveness, which is really what he wants, so that God will agree to go with them and, in fact, inhabit this, not inhabit, but abide by, visit and abide by this tabernacle, which Moses now sees the need for. And we don't have time, I think, to do this in the detail that it requires, but I invite our viewers to sit down with the text and read the conversation aloud slowly. And you could see we had one moment of softening already before Moses descended into the camp, but the conversation now has five successive moments of softening where Moses pleads, God gives him a little. I don't think that God is playing hard to get. I think he wants Moses to continue to make all the arguments, to argue the thing all the way through. First, okay, the promised land. Okay, I'll send my angel. I want to know, if you don't go with us, I don't know if this angel is good news or bad news. He might be ratting us out for misconduct. Okay, I'll go with you. Just with me, because I found favor in your eyes. If you don't go with us, he says, who will we be? And just as this is the golden transition, where Moses moves from talking about that people or this people to identifying himself with them. Way back when, God first encountered, when Moses first encountered God and he got the mission, Moses says, who am I to go unto Pharaoh and take the people out? And the answer was, I will be with you. The answer to the question, who am I, Moses is, you are the one with whom I will be. That is your identity. Moses now turns the tables on God and says, who are we if you don't go with us? And it's at that point that he starts using the first person plural. He identifies with the people. And at that particular point, I'm very pleased. Moses now says, please, God, show me your ways. He asks for a revelation. And it's not answered. He doesn't get an answer yet. A little down the road, he tries again. Show me, please, your glory. Moses hasn't given up on his desire to know God, but he adds this time, because we are your people. So the request now to know more about God is no longer just the personal desire for knowledge of the Lord the way he had back at the burning bush, but it's now connected to the mission that he's accepted and the people that he's accepted. If I don't know something more about who you are, we can't go on. And here is one of the most beautiful and exquisite moments in the whole Torah. God's partial revelation and a personal revelation to Moses of what the tradition calls his midot, his attributes. And we don't go through them in detail, but he puts Moses in the rock. He covers his face. He allows him to see his backside, whatever this is. And he bespeaks his name and his being in a way that adds to what Moses has known before. And there's one, the guts of it is this crucial revelation. I am a merciful and gracious God filled with loving kindness and loyal devotion. That's the big news. That's the big news. A God who can forgive iniquity.
Indeed, even before this dramatic revelation, the very acceptance of the people and of Moses' pleadings have prepared the way by demonstrating God's capacity for forgiveness. And that introduces a new understanding of God. A God whom we have seen already in Exodus as a power who can destroy, who can liberate, who can overawe, a God who can legislate, is now also seen to be a God capable of forgiveness.
Yep. Look, this is, John, this is indispensable for the whole mission of this people. They've been given a charge which is, let's put it plainly, impossible. The commandments as given, all of the ordinances, in a way presuppose failure. They say, if someone beats his slave and knocks out his teeth, he shall go free for nothing. If you strike your father and mother, you will be put to death. The expectation is, you shall not kill. But when someone kills, this is what follows. So the whole covenant is written, the whole law is written with a view of the unlikelihood of full compliance. They're human beings, after all. They will fail. But the order to be a people apart, to live differently, to have this higher aspiration, to try to be holy as the Lord your God is holy, that's a very lofty aspiration. And the question that hasn't been asked or answered before is, what's the price of failure? We were told in no uncertain terms, anybody that sacrifices to any deity but the Lord will be put to death, period. Several times. And we're now in a position of having found out that even on this occasion, where the covenant has not just been violated in the small, but has been violated at its foundation in idolatry and having in breaking the marital vow of singular devotion to this God, they're now told that it's possible to be forgiven at least once, even for that. And that means it should be possible to embrace this mission, because the world is the kind of place and its ruler is the kind of ruler that is willing to work with fragile, vulnerable, wayward people, providing they will aspire high, repent, and rededicate themselves. And that's partly why I want to even say that this episode with the golden calf, in addition to being shameful and disgraceful, is, in terms of the unfolding political narrative of the founding of the people, not only necessary, but in a way, a desirable episode. The people previously consented twice to this covenant, but they didn't really understand what they were consenting to, and they were not wholeheartedly in it. The Midrash says God held a mountain over their head at Sinai. What choice did they have? He made them an offer they couldn't refuse. Just as when Adam and Eve transgressed, and only then did they hear the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden and developed a relation to him, only in transgression and forgiveness are the people now ready to choose God in the way in which God has already chosen them. And it's not for nothing that the immediate sequel to this is that when Moses brings the covenant in the tablets down the new time, they are eager, they have repented, they are worried, and the verdict from on high is, yes, there is mercy. We can now say yes, knowing that the world will accept us in our striving, our failing, our rededication.
Dr. Cass, up to this point, we've been discussing the political and historical dimension of the story. I wonder, as we conclude this conversation, if we can zoom out and look at the narrative placement of the story and see if that has anything to teach us.
Well, I've in a way alluded to this in several ways. First of all, in this last third of Exodus, which is primarily devoted to the tabernacle, the instructions for its building, and then concluding with six chapters, the building according to the instructions, those two sections that deal with the tabernacle sandwich the story of the golden calf and Moses' pleading on behalf of the people for forgiveness. That literary sandwiching suggests that the meaning of the tabernacle is somehow related to the meaning of the episode that it has as its filler. And the way we've talked about it has, I think, made that clear. The tabernacle exists in part to deal with the wildness that lurks in the human soul. It deals with human beings' longings to be in touch with God. It deals with the fact that they can't do it just by conversation with God alone in their heads, but they need visible, tangible, and aesthetically pleasing instruments for doing so, but it has to be done under order and measure. And so we see, as a result of the way this is laid out, the reader, along with Moses, gets an instruction of the necessity of ritual, of sacrifice, of official places of worship, and the whole way in which this enables the divine to enter into daily life of human beings, and not just once upon a time and on the mountain. It also, I think, solidifies, it solves certain kinds, it solves is too strong. It goes in the direction of solving certain problems that we are left with when we enter this particular part of the story. Yes, the people have consented twice to the covenant, but we know them as still slavish, restless, quarrelsome. They still have all kinds of untested tendencies, and they still have longings for the ways of old. And we don't know how much they are going to accept leadership and whether they will rebel, if not over food and water, what next? The covenant, as I've said, is we know what's going to happen if they keep it. But nothing has been said about what happens when there's breakage. And we need to know that sooner rather than later. And here we get a chance to know that when it's broken fundamentally. God hasn't said what's going to happen if something is broken, and if can it be broken with impunity? Who is going to enforce this? And does he have a human champion who can actually administer the law, or does he have to find some other way of enforcing the law so that he has to continually be on the scene rather than allow his way to pass into human hands? And finally, Moses, who has done everything that he's supposed to do, has yet to become the leader of the people as God's people whom he, Moses, embraces despite their failings and shortcomings. Those are problems that we entered into this story with, and at least to some extent, they were all addressed here. They're not solved, and these are things we could carry with us going forward. There is a theological and there is a political problem that we're left with at the end of the golden calf story. Theological problem is Moses comes down the mountain after this last success with the new tablets, bringing them back to the people, but his face is shining with shafts of light beaming from his face. One could say that he has, "I will be with you," stamped on his face. It's the divine light reflected, the divine glory of the epiphany that he's had is now shining from his face, and the people are standoffish and afraid. He brings them forward. There's a long details of that. But the question now here is Moses has now been elevated beyond belief. His standing couldn't be higher. And the question is there this danger of his being too high and of the people worshiping Moses? That's a danger that Moses immediately deals with by turning his elevated status to the tabernacle. And the very next words one hears from him is he asks for donations to build the tabernacle. He uses his godlike standing to redirect their attention to God Almighty and to providing him the sanctuary where he'll abide. What's not settled is his now elevated political position. He has an elevated political standing like never before, which he's going to need. But that is going to be challenged. And it's not clear that the people, or at least some of the people, are going to stand for his elevation. They challenged him before. The nobles have never challenged him. That's waiting for him down the road. But I have to say that this miserable story of the golden calf, a disgrace on our people as it's read elsewhere, is, I think, from the point of view of people formation, an indispensable, and I even want to say majestic tale in which real problems, problems of the people, problems of the covenant, problems that God has, and especially problems of Moses, their leader, are addressed and put on their way to rectification.
This whole theme of Moses, his leadership, his shortcomings, and his virtues is the theme we should discuss in our next conversation. Dr. Cass, thank you.
Thanks very much, John.